Hi, I'm Talissa.
And I'm Rachel, and this is Transatlantic Crime, a true crime podcast that covers stories from each side of the pond. Every week, we will both cover a separate story with a running theme.
Disclaimer, this podcast will contain swearing and details that some people may find offensive. If you are of a sensitive disposition, listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Transatlantic Crime.
So close.
Yeah, I was just about to say we had some really nice feedback this week. I mean, it was nice feedback, but it was also like, where the fuck is my podcast? Rebecca, who I love, messaged and was like, it was like a subtle way of saying, where the fuck is my podcast? She just put like a screenshot of like last week's and went, it is Monday, right? that's like the way your boss goes, that report's due, right?
What time is it? You just got here?
It's not Tuesday, is it? It's Monday, right? So, yeah, sorry the episode was out late last week. That's totally on me.
You did a great job.
Thanks, mate. I thought I did as well. Yeah. I'm getting quite good at editing, aren't I?
Yeah, good job.
Cheers, pal. It makes it all worth it, you know, when you get good feedback.
Yeah, normally, so I edit it and I try and put it out.
Normally when you edit it, it sounds like shit.
Exactly. No, but I try and put it out at midnight American time, which is 8 a.m. British time. Sometimes I put it a little bit earlier, but just so that everyone gets it on the same time, same day, Monday.
Yeah, like on the same. Yeah. And that works really well.
Yeah.
Because like as soon as I wake up, I check for my own podcast because I'm like that.
Yeah.
And then it's always there. Your absolute rigidity in getting out on time really showed with my sloppiness. But in my defense, right, this is what happened. I didn't feel very well. Mm. So I called in sick to work and then I got home and I was like, right, I don't feel very well. So I'm just going to take my time and edit this podcast, which literally involves like looking at the screen and like pressing the space bar a few times and like just get it done at my own pace.
Yeah.
Then the washing machine flooded.
What?
So
no.
I turned around and Carly was just stood near the washing machine and there was just water all over the kitchen floor.
Oh,
and I was like, holy hell. It was like biblical. And I was like, ah. So basically, I had to stop editing about six times just to like get bowlfuls of water
man.
Chuck them over the balcony because the drain's fucked. So we've been washing up in the bath for the last couple of days.
Oh wow. Like,
and like
the
I'll go to run the kitchen tap and I'm like, no. So if anyone remembers that thing that was under the sink that me and Carly fixed, remember the bog of eternal stench?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember that from
broken again.
Oh no.
And I was like, I'm not doing that again.
Why do you guys have to keep fixing things? Why can't you call your landlord?
Well, I hope he doesn't listen to this podcast because we have a dog.
Mm.
So I don't want the landlord like poking around.
Okay.
Because we're not supposed to have one. So like every time he comes around, we just hide it. But the thing is, we're really good tenants and I think it's too late to throw us out now. So hopefully we've got away with that.
Can't you just be like, this one time we're watching a dog or a friend just left their dog here for the day.
Do you remember the initial lie I told was my nan had bunion surgery so we had to look after our dog because she couldn't walk it, like I came out with that lie like off the top of my head as well. I was just like my neighbor went, oh, you got a dog, and I went, no, it's not my dog, my nan had bunion surgery and she can't walk it, and it's just never left. I bet he thinks my nan's dead or her foot's been removed. My nan died like 12 years ago, so
good old
none of this
lies.
Is true. I don't lie very often. I hate lying, but I want a dog and it's unreasonable not to let me have one, especially one that small.
Yeah.
I've seen bigger rats. Like, that's unfair. Yeah. And we cleaned out the bog of eternal stench so that he doesn't have to do it. And I fixed the shower on my own so he doesn't have to do it because we don't want him around here. So if you ask me, it's like even Stevens now.
You're doing all of this for your dog.
Literally. Getting Hep B.
Do you have any true crime news or podcast recommendations or documentaries?
Yeah. So last week, I couldn't remember the name of a book that I really liked, and it was called The Fact of a Body, is what it's called.
Okay. I will add it to the book list.
And it's about, so yes, very much so, because the author is a woman and she was sexually abused as a child, and she's amazing. Like, she studies as a lawyer and then she decides that she doesn't want to do that, and then she studies as a writer and then she wrote this book, and it's true crime, but it's like one of the best written books I've ever read, true crime or not. She's a fucking incredible writer, and she writes about her own abuse like really candidly, and she was also looking into this crime that happened really close to where she grew up, which is about a paedophile. So it's almost like she's going through talking about her own abuse and looking at this crime, and she's almost trying to like not sympathize with the paedophile, but she's like looking at his life and like seeing what led to him becoming a paedophile and the help that he didn't get and all this stuff. And it's just incredible. Wow. I couldn't put it down. I finished it in like 4 days.
Okay. Well, we're adding it to the list for sure.
Yeah. And like, I really want you to read it because I want to talk about it.
Okay. Yes, you know what we should do?
What book are you?
We should have, maybe we should do like a book club, and that can be our Patreon.
Yes. Okay. Oh my God, Rachel, that is so clever. Yeah. True crime book
New
club.
New year, if you.
As if you need any more homework.
If you follow us in the new year, then look out for that. Yes. I think we're going to do like a drunk holiday episode on Patreon.
100%. Yeah,
so look out for that in the next few weeks. Christmas is soon, Talissa. Oh, by the way, this episode comes out on the week of Thanksgiving, so I hope all of our American listeners have a safe and wonderful Thanksgiving.
I've been through this before. Why are you having a fake Christmas before Christmas? Stop it.
What, you're going to turn down delicious, amazing food and that's all you do all day? Talissa.
Okay. You are right, because what's better than one Christmas? Two Christmases.
Exactly.
Why am I slagging off two Christmases?
You don't even have to worry about the pressure of gifts, getting the wrong gift, spending too much money or anything like that. It's just food. And if you like football, you can watch football, but it's mainly food.
Yeah.
And
it's a day off work, isn't it?
2 days, Thursday and Friday.
Next year, we're having Thanksgiving in England, even though isn't it about kicking out the English? Isn't that what you're celebrating?
No, it's a bullshit holiday. Maybe I'll cut that out. I don't want to insult people. It's a holiday celebrating how...
You don't want to insult racists.
We apparently...
You don't want to insult pro-colonizers. Fuck them.
Yeah. It's a holiday where we apparently made friends with the Native Americans and they helped us, and it was harvest time and we all came together and had a great harvest meal, the Pilgrims and
then
the
we
Native
gave them
Americans.
Blankets with smallpox on,
and then we gave them diseases and we took their land and we killed them, and that is why
yeah it
should be okay. I'm gonna get on my soapbox a little bit.
I love angry Rachel.
On Thanksgiving and Columbus Day, which is now Indigenous Peoples Day, you should really be giving your money and your attention to Native Americans and what they're going through and what they have gone through. And you should be putting time into that rather than, oh, it's yes. Thanksgiving. Let's eat a bunch of food. Yes, definitely. But try and spend your money at places that help Native Americans. That is my soapbox. That is my TED Talk.
Yeah.
Do it.
Thanks for coming. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's totally fair. Like, I was, I've got really obsessed with this on Instagram. There's a girl and she's like Indigenous Canadian.
Mm.
And she does throat singing, like with her mum.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
And she's on Instagram. Mm. Do you know her? Have you seen her before?
I think you reposted her like a few days ago, right?
Yeah. I can't, you know what, I'm just going to waste time like looking for her right now. I'll find her and then I'll put her on our Instagram. But you should all follow her because she's super interesting. Like, she teaches you about Indigenous culture and like the names for stuff. And I just love learning about stuff like that. I think it's amazing. Because really, like, do you remember when we went on that road trip and I had never seen anybody who was Indigenous before?
Yeah.
And we were in that cafe and that Indigenous guy came in with his mum. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I just couldn't even speak because he was so beautiful. Like, he just looked like the original human, like what a human should look like. He had like gorgeous, glossy black hair down his back and he was really tall. And he had like fantastic cheekbones and he looked so strong. And I was like, that is a human built to live not playing on his Xbox, like with fat potato hands. Like, it was a real culture shock for me because I'm just used to seeing white men who look like potatoes.
Since you mentioned the Instagram woman in Canada, this is for like European listeners, but in Canada, Indigenous people are called First Nation people, and in America, they're called Native Americans. Just a little
right,
fact.
Okay, that's the correct terminology.
I mean, you can say Indigenous as well.
Also, I learned that Aboriginal, like, you know, in Australia, they call like the First Nation people Aboriginal. Yeah. That apparently that is the name for anybody who is the first people to live on that piece of land.
Okay,
but they just adopted it for Australian Indigenous people.
Yeah,
they call them Aboriginal, whereas like that, it's just, you can use that as a name for anybody apparently.
Okay,
like the word just means everyone. So yeah, I've been learning about like Indigenous cultures because I just find it super interesting.
Yeah, it really is.
And then I was trying to think of like, what's my Indigenous culture? Because I'm like Scottish, Welsh, Irish, like I think it's like Celtic.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and then I was like looking into like Celtic cultures, and then there was a thing that was like the word Celtic came from Romans because they came to Britain and saw these people who were like, apparently they like fought naked and like drank loads. I was like, sounds about right.
It's true. I've been doing that as well, like, cuz I'm also Irish and German and Austrian and all this kind of stuff. Any ancestry, I think, is really, it's kind of cool if you're Celtic because you're just like, well, I just drank and painted myself blue while I lived in Ireland.
That hanging was out.
Yeah.
Kissing the Gaul stone. What was it? The Galway stone or whatever the fuck
the
it was
Blarney
called?
Stone.
Yeah, that's it.
What do you call
it? A little twisty.
What's the thing near you? We should get into our story soon, but what is the Stonehenge?
Stonehenge?
Yeah, making big rocks.
Making stone circles, like druids. Yeah.
That's what we did.
They did do human sacrifices, though. Mm.
It was all messed up back then.
Yeah. Value on human life was minimal. I just got a text from Carly that just popped up on my screen with a picture of the dog saying, "The perfect crime."
That's a great segue.
Yes.
Into our story.
That is a great segue.
This week.
What is the theme, Rach?
The theme is robberies.
Yes.
Do you want to elaborate?
Okay. Just like great big robberies. Yes. I mean, it's a working title. Yeah. Let's be honest.
I like how we always like announce what the episode is in when whoever is listening, they already know.
Already know. We're just checking we've written the correct story. It sounds like it's for your benefit.
No,
it's for us.
It's for us too. Validation that we did the right thing.
So, you're first this week.
Okay. All right. I'm going to get
go.
Straight
just
into
go.
It.
We've both got go to work.
And go.
Yeah.
Okay. So, my story this week is the circus robbery in Las Vegas.
We stayed there.
We stayed there. Yes, we did.
That place stinks.
you can talk about it in a little bit, what you thought about it, because there's a part where I kind of describe it. But actually, this might sound familiar to people because it was made into a documentary on Netflix. I don't know how many episodes there are, but this is like two of the episodes. There's more about other stories,
Ooh.
But it's called Heist on Netflix.
So watching that.
Yeah, it's really good. Okay. In 1993, then 21-year-old Heather Tallchief was working in Las Vegas, Nevada. She was dating a man called Roberto Solis. Solis was 48 years old, a convicted murderer who spent 20 years in prison for that conviction.
Babe. What are you doing?
Sweet baby angel. Even though he had been sentenced to life, he had just been released on parole a year prior in 1992 after he had written poetry while in prison, and after his poetry was published, other well-known artists advocated to the parole board on Solis's behalf.
I bet those poems are dog shit.
To
be fair, there's not many poems I like.
I'm not a huge poem person either, so I can respect when it's amazing or beautiful.
When it's incredible, yeah. But most people go, I wrote a poem, and you're like, please don't read it. For the love of God, please.
Not knocking anyone. It can be a very therapeutic thing. Not for me, but for other people. But put it into a song.
Oh,
and
it's
then...
such a thin line as to whether it's shit.
Yeah. I agree. Anyways, so he wrote poetry in prison, and his poet name was Pancho Aguila, but he had a bunch of other fake names as well. His real name was Roberto Solis, but he went by tons of different names.
Bit of a red flag.
Yeah. Yeah, so he got out on parole because a bunch of other artists were like, this man is amazing. He has amazing poetry. You should let him out. I don't know if that is
a
reason.
That doesn't mean he should get let out of prison.
How many serial killers?
John Wayne Gacy did some okay paintings.
Exactly. Like, that's what I was going to say.
Don't let the fucker out.
How many serial killers and murderers make pictures and paintings?
Do you know what? Hitler was a fantastic painter. He was actually amazing. Like, if you look up his artwork, it's fucking good. He went to art school.
I think that...
Again, not a good guy.
No, and sometimes really creative people do think out of the box and think that they can cross the lines on things. And sometimes that works in art, but not in human life.
Separate the art from the artist. Like, that is... the phrase of 2021.
Yeah, of the past 20
R. Kelly,
years.
Michael Jackson, right. John Wayne Gacy. You're all in the same category for me.
Yeah, okay. So he got out on parole because of his poetry. So when the two met, they met in a bar. He came up to her and he asked her if he could buy her a drink. She had no money. By that time, she had been addicted to drugs. So she was like, yeah, I have no money. Please buy me a drink. And so they soon started dating, and they moved in with each other pretty quick. She was looking for work, and Solis convinced her to apply to Loomis, which is a cash handling and security company.
I bet he did.
Yeah. They drive those security
trucks
around with money in them. They have, you know, the little windows, and they're armored and things like that.
There's actually, sorry to interrupt you, but there's actually a podcast about that, which I've been quite interested in listening to.
Oh, really?
Apparently there's a whole, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like a whole podcast about people breaking into those trucks because it's supposed to be the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, because it's armored.
So yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, she got a job driving them. Mm. Yeah, she was soon hired, where her job was to drive a truck transporting large amounts of cash to various casinos around the city, dropping off her coworkers to fill up casino ATMs with cash before continuing on to the next location. So they would just drive around Vegas, go to the casinos and hotels. Mm-hmm. She would park the truck. Two guys would go inside with big bags of cash and fill up cash machines. And that was her job.
Such a dangerous job.
Yeah.
Not hers, but the guys holding the cash.
Well, everyone involved.
Anyone involved, yeah.
They said for the job, everyone who worked there had to do, like, gun training. And,
Whoa.
Yeah, they said that she was actually, like, a really good shot. Like, she was talented at it.
Loads of women are, apparently.
Really?
My mum is a fantastic shot, which is really worrying. Really?
No, that's amazing, because if you ever need protection, like, Go to Talissa's mom's house if there's a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, fuck me, she's a good shot. She's straight in the front.
Cool. I will never find out. I feel like I'm too scared to hold a gun and shoot it.
I've shot an air rifle, but that's not really the same. Like, that would barely kill a bird.
So she got that job. She came from a rough background and followed most things that Solis told her to do. So obviously she got this job. She struggled with addiction, and Solis was a partier, and he easily manipulated her. At one point, the two bought a multitude of guns, and they often went shooting together, with Solis even training her to use an AK-47. Why does anyone need to use an AK-47? No one does.
Yeah, you're not part of a militia. No.
Exactly. So, when he started talking to her about the possibility of robbing a Vegas casino, it didn't take her long to get on board. There's some speculation that she was, like, excited about it, or she was manipulated. Probably a little bit of both. I mean, you're 21.
In her defense, she is on drugs.
Yeah.
Those are things seem like a good idea when you're on drugs.
And he was, like, into... So in the documentary, they do a lot of reenactments for this story. And the guy kind of looks like a Latino version of Charles Manson.
Oh, God. Is he really short?
I'm not sure if he is in real life. I'm not sure. But he did look like it in the reenactments. But...
Bit Jesus-y looking.
Yeah, and she said that he
was... evil Jesus.
She said that he was very into, like, black magic and stuff like that, so...
Right, that's not real. Carry on.
They would do drugs together, and they would do, like, rituals and stuff like that, and... The first part of the episode was called Sex, Magic, Money, because they kind of dwell on that a little bit. So, yeah, he starts talking about robbing a Vegas casino. She's like, you're crazy, but okay. Solis came up with a plan, asking Heather detailed questions about her job and where she went each day and how much money she collected with the other two men on her team. A few weeks before their planned robbery, Solis rented a warehouse space and put up a sign for armored vehicle repair. She was like, this isn't happening, this isn't happening. And he just kept moving forward and moving forward. And he was like, no, this is truly the plan. Like, she got her job. And then over the next 6 weeks, he planned this robbery. So it was quick.
This is like when you say you're going to make a film when you're on coke. And then you later go, that was the stupidest thing I've ever said.
Talissa, story of my life. Not coke, though. More like drinking. Yeah, let's make a movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's asking her detailed questions about her job. He's, like, writing down the route. He ends up renting a warehouse space, putting up a fake sign. While Solis solidified the robbery plans, Heather didn't think it was going to happen, and she wanted to back out. But the day got closer and closer, and she was too afraid to back out by then. Mm. On October 1st, 1993... she was working her regular shift, driving the truck with her two co-workers, Scott and Steve. Their first stop was Circus Circus Casino and Hotel.
Oh, God.
Circus Circus was built in 1968, and by the 1990s, it was trying to appeal to families. It had been renovated a bunch of times to offer carnival games and cheap rooms to make it more family-friendly. I didn't know that part.
I'll tell you this, it doesn't look like it. It's been renovated a bunch of times.
Well, no, we stayed in it, 2018?
And there was soliciting going on in the hallways.
And
the smell.
It smelled like an ashtray and...
it smelled like an ass.
I mean, that which it too. Did.
It smelled like someone had used an old ass for an ashtray.
Yeah.
And then just dump that on the floor.
Oh, man. Because, okay, so in Vegas, if you go to, like, a nice casino hotel, like Treasure Island, they have, like a special air conditioning system because you can smoke while you're playing the slots.
Which is the best thing ever.
Yeah,
I was in my element.
You can't, I mean, in most places now you can't smoke inside. But when you stay at Circus Circus, they don't have like a nice ventilation system. So the smoke is just in the air everywhere.
It's like a bar in the 90s, isn't it? It is. It's just like sticky floor, sweaty people, cigarette smoke,
and the
old hair.
The shitty thing about it too, though, is like it's still advertised as like a family-friendly hotel because there's a circus and a carnival. So there's kids all over.
Yeah, if you want your kids to get emphysema.
If you want your kids to get emphysema or kidnapped by some creepy dude who's staying in the cheapest room in on the Vegas Strip.
Who the fuck takes their kids to Vegas? It is the most inappropriate place for kids.
It's just too much.
It's debauchery. It's like taking your kid to the seventh circle of hell. It's just tits and fanny and sharks. And
huge drinks of alcohol. Just people just carrying and smoking.
In cowboy boot shaped drinks. Yeah. Like, I've still got that fucking massive cowboy boot drink that you like stole for me because I just wanted it. The biggest drinks you could possibly buy in one go. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's Circus Circus now. But back in the 90s, I think because it was like newly renovated, I think it was actually kind of nice.
Yeah.
I actually have a friend whose mom got married there.
Oh, that's sweet in a way.
And that friend is also the friend who made our theme music for our podcast.
Nice. Also, I'm not married. I've never been proposed to. So I don't know who the fuck I'm judging. At least she's married. I'd marry someone at Circus Circus.
Would you?
They asked.
Talissa, if you ever get to that point, I'm stopping
you. I don't know, man. You're better than this.
I'm diving into the altar at Circus Circus. Slow motion. Good luck.
You're gonna get stuck on the sticky floor.
No.
Oh, you dive on the floor at Circus Circus for me?
I'd stop you from getting married there, yes.
Just covered in cigarette ash and old Band-Aids.
You're like, look at me. Is this what you want? Is this what you want your wedding day to be?
Just peel off an old condom off your arm.
All right.
Anyway.
Yeah. So yeah, family friendly, Circus Circus. It's also right at the northern end of the Las Vegas Strip. And fun fact, it has the only permanent circus in the United States. I didn't know that.
Wow. Yeah. That is fun.
Yeah. It is on the Las Vegas Strip, which is where you want to stay if you want to see Vegas for the first time. And it's the cheapest, but you have to like walk all the way down the strip to see things that you actually want to see. So it's not really that worth it.
Do you remember we got lost as well?
We walked
How
into
did that
like
even happen?
Some like weird camping.
An old parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had like trailers.
Yeah. We're like, I don't think this
They must
is
be the
Vegas.
Circus performers.
Maybe it was. Okay.
Yeah.
So October 1st, 1993, they stop off at the casino underground parking where Scott and Steve get out with their bags of cash to deliver it to the ATMs around the casino and hotel. So obviously this is going to take them a while, which Solis had planned for. And also in the documentary, they interview Scott and Steve and they're these just like, two old guys who are like, yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad they lived.
No one dies in
this. I saw Scott and Steve getting one to the face. I really
no,
did.
No, nobody dies in this. So, or really gets Good. Hurt, actually. It's
That's
just
great.
A clean old robbery.
Okay.
But yeah, Scott and Steve are in this documentary and they're just talking about how Heather was hired because she was young and pretty and she didn't know how to drive and she wouldn't stop at stop signs and she would always get lost in the parking lot.
And she's on drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if she was at that point, but yeah. Just being a 21-year-old, have fun.
Yeah, to be fair, when I was 21, I did not need to be high to fuck up driving.
No. Imagine yourself at 21 driving a huge security truck.
An armored vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
That was her. She wasn't like serious about it. So once they're in the building, once Scott and Steve are in the building, Heather sped off with the remaining cash they had to deliver to the other casinos still in the back of the truck. She drove straight to the garage warehouse where Solis was waiting for her and she parked the truck inside. They grab the bags and Solis had disguises ready. Heather dressed up as an old woman and Solis dressed up in a suit. Okay. It was going to be like he was her doctor and she was an old lady with a wheelchair.
So where's Steve and Scott right now?
They're at Circus Circus wandering around thinking that Heather just got lost again. She's just fucking
legged it outside.
Yeah.
Right, okay, perfect, perfect.
Yeah, even in the documentary, they're like, yeah, we came out on the other side and we're like, oh God, Heather's done it again. She forgot where to meet us.
That's the perfect crime. Mm-hmm.
It really is. Depending on your dumbness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so they're quickly getting dressed up in their disguises. They're packing the cash into cardboard boxes and they drive another car out of the garage to the post office where Solis mailed the boxes off and then they headed to the airport.
That is so clever. Yeah.
Also in 1993 when like it was way easier to do that kind of stuff. Like now.
Nobody's asking what's in that box.
Yeah. Or getting on a plane. I don't know about you,
but like...
Nobody cares like, then.
Oh, this looks nothing like you on the passport. Like, not a problem.
Yeah.
Please walk on through. Do they ask what is in the box at the post office when you post it in America?
When I send stuff to you, yeah.
What about it just in America to other people? Like domestic?
No, actually they don't. They just say like, do you have like lighter fluid in there? If you do, then you can't send it.
Oh, right.
And that's it.
Oh, they always ask what's in the package. Mm-hmm. And like, apparently my dad was like, why do you need to know that? The woman was like, it's for like insurance purposes. Like if it's worth loads of money, then you need to insure it. Like it costs like £2 extra or whatever to make sure that if it's lost by the post office, you can get your money back. And my dad was like, you don't need to know that. Right. I was like, oh, just tell her that it's just fucking playing cards.
She's just like, doing her damn job.
Honestly, people like you.
But I do have to do that when I send stuff to you. You have to declare, like, how much is the whatever it is that I'm sending you. Nothing that I send anyone is worth like... anything, though. It's like $1.
I sent you, like, Percy Pigs. Yeah. I know, the woman was like, what's in here? I was like, it's all Percy Pigs, all of it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, they sent it off in the cardboard boxes and they head to the airport. Meanwhile, Scott and Steve are standing around Circus Circus holding empty bags, thinking that Heather forgot where to park again. When they realized that she'd actually left without them, they called the police and their work to let them know. Police immediately began searching for the truck. They estimated that the two had stolen over $3 million.
Wow.
Yeah. Over 2 weeks, the police searched for them, bringing in the FBI for backup. They searched the couple's apartment, finding brochures for Mexico and the Caribbean. They also found
Come on.
They also found the armored truck with the empty bags in the warehouse. They started talking to different people. Eventually, federal warrants were issued charging Tall Chief and Solis with bank larceny. The FBI was now searching for them.
Well, yeah, because they left, right?
Yeah. And they stole a lot of money. When they brought the FBI in, I wonder if there's like a cap or like a minimum of money where the FBI have to be brought in, like over $1 million or, and it's all cash too.
Yeah, because I thought it was just if it goes into a different state, it's immediately a federal thing.
But they don't know if they've gone to another state yet. Like they don't know where they've gone.
That's very true. Yeah.
But yeah, the FBI are brought in. So while all this is happening, like that was in like the 2 weeks after the robbery happened. So the two got to the airport, they first flew to Denver and then they were still in their disguises and they hired a limo driver, who drove them around to like choose a hotel to stay at. Then they traveled by train around the US until eventually they flew to St. Martin in the Caribbean. And there, Heather found out that she was pregnant.
No, Heather.
Yeah.
What have you done?
I know. Also, the FBI found the limo driver, and he told them that he drove around a strange couple, which was like an elderly woman in a wheelchair and a man that seemed like a doctor.
She really went for it with that costume.
Yeah. Well, she's saying in the documentary, like, she even put in, like, different color eye contacts. she was trying to put them on, and she was just like so nervous after all of that had happened, and she couldn't put them in, and she was just like laughing and like freaking out. So she really got into it.
Wow.
By now it's been like 2 months and they're in St. Martin in the Caribbean, and she finds out she's pregnant. They're trying to figure out what to do, so Solis was able to get them fake Dutch documents and they flew to Amsterdam. Almost a year after their robbery, Heather had her baby in Amsterdam and they named it Emilio. It was a boy. Not too long after, Solis was, he started cheating on Heather like straight away.
That's nice.
Yeah. This was not a lasting love story. So she decided to leave him. She was able to get fake documents again, this time adopting the identity of a British citizen by the name of Donna Marie Eaton from Manchester. And Emilio's name was changed to Dylan to match his fake British passport. So they both had fake British passports.
Dylan. Cute name.
Yeah. So when Heather left Solis, she only left with around $18,000 of the stolen money. He kept the rest of it.
Fucking hell.
So she
worked I guess if you want to leave, you want to leave.
Yeah. And he sounds like he was more like in control of things anyway. Like he wanted to be in control of stuff and wouldn't let her. He would like give her money.
Mm.
So she worked as a maid around Amsterdam, focusing on giving her son the most normal life that he could have. By that time, Heather had made the FBI's most wanted list, being one of the only females on it. She was the first female on it in the history of the FBI most wanted list.
Wow, that's a pretty good claim to fame.
Yeah. She stayed on it for 12 years. They were in hiding for 12 years. But their British passports only lasted for 10 years, so in September 2005, Heather dropped off her son at school in Amsterdam. She told him to, in quotes, practice his guitar, have fun at his sporting club, do his homework, and I'll see you soon. And then she went back to Vegas and turned herself in to the U.S. District Court, saying it was the right thing to do.
No. Well, what's going to happen to your son?
Well, he's a citizen of Amsterdam, and I think she had like planned this so she had people taking care of him.
Okay.
So her lawyers fought hard for a light sentence, saying that she was manipulated by Solis. In the end, Heather was convicted, and she only served 5 years in federal prison before being released in 2010.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. 5 years for all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She did okay. Yeah.
She says that she doesn't know what happened to Solis after she left him and that she is not in contact with him. He was never apprehended by authorities and he is still being searched for to this day, remaining on the FBI's most wanted list. The FBI notes that Solis should be considered armed and dangerous. And that is the story of the robbery at Circus Circus Casino and Hotel in Las Vegas.
Oh my god, that was amazing. I can't believe a murderer was just like...
Right?
You're stupid fucks for letting him out of prison because of his wiener poetry. Like, in the first place.
That would not fly now. I feel like too many people on social media would be like, "What? You did what?"
Yeah. They're lucky no one else is dead. Like, I don't know what he did for his first crime, but... He's obviously the sort of person that has no fear of the law.
I'll tell you what he did for his first crime. He murdered a security guard during an armored truck robbery in 1969. So almost the same thing.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's lucky no one else is dead. That was their bad.
Yeah. Exactly.
I want to know what celebrities were like, he's amazing. Just let him out.
I don't know. Back in the 70s and 80s.
He might be dead now. Like,
he could. He's what would he be now? 75-ish. He was born in 1945. So yeah, he'd be dead.
Doing well to get to that age.
Like, yeah.
He's probably dead. Okay. Well, I hope she got to see her son again.
Yeah, I think I don't want to like ruin the whole documentary. You should just watch it. It's called Heist.
Oh, okay.
Netflix.
Okay.
Check it out.
I will.
Let us know if you've watched it.
100%. Yeah. Yes. Okay, right. I'm going to get stuck into my story straight away.
Okay.
My story this week is the Great Train Robbery.
Ooh.
So that might not mean anything to you, but in England, like, the Great Train Robbery was like the event of the 60s.
Yes,
like,
I have no idea about it.
It was. No, me neither. Like, I've always heard the term, like, oh, Ronnie Biggs, and I've always heard the term the Great Train Robbery, and I never knew what happened. Yeah. So I was like, right, I'm going to fucking educate myself on this. Okay,
let's
so.
Let's get into it.
In 1963, I was gonna. In 1963, a team of men planned to rob a train heading from Glasgow to London, obviously Glasgow in Scotland. Mm-hmm. The plan started with 33-year-old Gordon Goody. These are all kind of like nicknames. Okay. Like, his name is like, I don't know, like Richard Edward Graham Goody or whatever, but they were all just called nicknames. Okay. So 33-year-old Gordon Goody and 32-year-old Buster Edwards. So Gordon Goody was born in Putney in London, and he was still living there with his mum. He's 33. Come on, mate. Buster Edwards was born on the 27th of January 1932 in Lambeth, London. These are both South London mm-hmm. places. And he was the son of a barman. After leaving school, he worked in a sausage factory where he began his criminal career. I just thought it was really funny to leave in. He began his career by stealing meat to sell on the post-war black market.
There's a joke in there for sure.
100% there's a joke in there. I bet he got loads of shit as well.
Yeah.
Like working at a sausage factory. In obviously post-war black market, so like post-war everyone was doing like rationing. So there was a good black market for everything.
Mm.
And during his national service in the RAF, he was detained for stealing cigarettes as well.
What?
So he loves to steal.
Okay.
When he returned to South London, he ran a drinking club and he became a professional criminal. So the two men knew another of the gang members, 29-year-old solicitor Brian Arthur Field, because he defended them before in other cases. He later became a solicitor's clerk at a company, and although he was only 28 at the time of the robbery, he was already apparently more prosperous than his boss, John Wheater. Part of the reason for this was that he was not averse to giving Goody and Edwards information about what his rich clients had in their country houses, which they would later go and rob.
Wow.
So
sounds like
he's like,
they all sound like some top
he doesn't
men.
Get his hands dirty.
Top honest men.
Yeah. He doesn't get his hands dirty, but he like he skims off the top of whatever yeah. they get.
He knows
basically.
The guys who do.
Yes. So he also passed on information from a security officer with the Royal Mail that there would be an overnight train travelling down the country carrying millions of pounds. Mm. So despite being enthusiastic criminals in terms of robberies, the men had never robbed a train, so they knew that they needed help. So they roped in a London gang called the South Coast Raiders. I mean, that's a bit of a shit name.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
Too cute.
Yeah, we're the South London Raiders. Raiders of what? Yeah.
The Lost Ark?
Yeah, it's not threatening.
No.
Sounds like a bit of a like raccoon through garbage type situation. This group included Tommy Wisby, Bob Welsh, and Jim Hussey, who were already accomplished train robbers.
Mm.
This group also included Roger Caudry, a man who was a specialist in the field and knew how to rig the train signals to stop the train. So that like a lot of planning is going into yeah. this. Other associates, including Ronnie Biggs, a man that Reynolds had previously met in jail, were added to the gang. And when they were all together, it comprised of about 16 men.
Wow, that's a lot.
So after months of, yeah, it is a lot, but you'll see why. So after a month of planning, at 18:50 on Wednesday, the 7th of August, 1963, the train set off from Glasgow, heading to Euston Station in London. It was scheduled to arrive at Euston at 4 a.m. the following morning. The train consisted of 12 carriages and carried 72 post office staff who sorted the mail during the journey. So mail was loaded onto the train at Glasgow and then at stops along the way. So local post office staff would hang mail on sacks on elevated side hooks at the side of the tracks that were caught by nets deployed by the onboard staff.
Yeah.
So the and sorted mail from the train was also dropped off at the same time on those same hooks.
Yeah.
So this seamless process meant that the train never had to stop.
Mm-hmm.
That's clever, right?
Yeah.
That's like just seems like a really like industrious way of
also
distributing
very simple. It's like, yeah, I guess we'll just hang these on and then you can just catch them with hooks. Good luck.
Yeah, it's crazy. So the second carriage was known as the high-value packages coach, and it carried large quantities of money and registered mail for sorting. So registered mail is just like, you have to get a signature when it's delivered.
Yeah.
So it's just like signed for, and it costs more money to send it. Usually this carriage contained about £300,000, but because the previous weekend had been a bank holiday weekend when no post was delivered, the total was now between 2.5 and 3 million pounds.
Wow.
So
that
was like
too.
The inside. Yeah, like I don't even know how much it is now. So that's like the inside info.
Mm.
At around 3 a.m. on the 8th of August, the driver, 58-year-old Jack Mills, stopped the train at a red light signal near Leighton Buzzard, which is just north of London. So the train has almost completed its journey, mm-hmm. basically. The train robbers had tampered with the light to make it red when it should have been green. And as a red signal wasn't expected here, a crew member climbed down from the train to call a signalman from a telephone at the side of the line. As he returned to the train, one of the robbers overpowered him. Meanwhile, the gang members entered the engine cabin from both sides, and one of the robbers struck the driver on the back of the head with a cosh and knocked him out. I had to look up what a cosh
was.
What
is it?
It's basically just a club.
Oh.
It's like anything that you hit.
like an
umbrella name for something that you, anything that you just smack someone around the head
okay.
with. Like, I think they use it in The Simpsons. Do you remember? I can't remember,
no.
like, why. Oh, no, it's when Homer becomes an astronaut. Like, one of the scientists, like, smacks him on the back of the head and knocks him out. And he's like, he wanted to come. It's really, really funny. It just reminded me of that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, they fucking knocked the driver out. And then the robbers had to move the train half a mile down the track where they planned to offload the money. So the plan was to move the first two carriages from the signals to the bridge. So the bridge was half a mile down the track. So they were going to move it from the signals to there
mm-hmm.
after detaching the carriages containing the rest of the regular mail. So they only wanted the first two carriages, the engine and the high value carriage.
Okay.
So the robbers had stretched a sheet across the line so they knew exactly where to stop the train. So this is why it needed 17 people. It's like properly...
Yeah.
Like an Ocean's 11 operation.
Full day's work.
Yeah. And when it stopped, the gang attacked the high-value carriage. So a man called Frank Dewhurst was in charge of the three postal workers in that carriage. And there was also an assistant inspector, Thomas Kett, in there. Both he and Frank were knocked out with coshes when they tried to stop the robbers. And the staff were no match for the gang, and there was no security officer or police help on board. So the staff were made to lie face down on the floor. The driver was handcuffed and placed down next to the other staff. 128 sacks of money were removed from the carriage with just 8 left remaining. They formed a human, basically the robbers formed a human chain and passed the sacks to one another until they were all loaded in the waiting truck. And that took about 20 minutes.
Wow.
Which is pretty risky.
Yeah.
The gang departed in their Austin Lodestar truck 30 minutes after the robbery had begun. And to mislead any potential witnesses, they used 2 Land Rovers, both of which had identical license plates. So if you reported, oh, I saw a Land Rover with this license plate, someone would be like, well, I saw a Land Rover with this license plate here. So
one went one
that
way,
was pretty clever.
One went the other way, probably.
Yeah, exactly. They then headed along minor roads, so like A roads, with a police radio so they could hear if anyone was after them. They arrived at a place called Leatherslade Farm near Oxford, which is, again, Oxford is like the middle of the country. It's just below Birmingham.
Yeah.
The farm was 27 miles from the robbery, and they arrived there at about 4:30 a.m. At this time, the first reports of the crime were being made, and they could hear that on the police radio. It was a rundown farm that the gang had bought 2 months earlier for their hideout.
This is such a movie.
So, I know. I think it is probably
like,
a movie.
You can picture all these
the movie,
things,
but...
like the chain of men, the handcuffed train driver, the dilapidated farmhouse.
Yeah, it's pretty epic. And at the farm, they again, you can imagine all of this. At the farm, they counted the proceeds and divided it into 16 full shares and several smaller sums of money intended for the associates of the gang.
I feel like that's
the members got around
trusting. Like, you have 16 men.
Yeah.
There's got to be somebody who maybe, like, pocketed something or...
slipped. Yeah. Well, there probably was, but there's so much money, you're not going to fucking care.
Yeah, that's true.
So the members got around £150,000 each, equivalent to £3 million today.
Whoa.
So what is 3 times 16? Oh, God. 32. No. 48.
Talissa, it's 1:30 in the morning. I can't do math right now.
It's 48. £48 million is what they stole.
That is nuts.
Yeah. Why the fuck is that on one carriage on a train with no one looking after it? I guess they thought the train's going like a million miles an hour. Like, it's never stopping. It's fine.
This is the one time we're doing this. It'll be fine.
Yep. Wow.
Yep.
The gang heard over the radio that the police believed that they would be in a 30-mile radius of the crime scene. This is because one of the staff members reported the gang member told them not to move for half an hour, which the police figured would give them a 30-mile radius in a fast car to get away. The crime was committed on a Thursday, and the gang was supposed to stay at the farm until Sunday, but they feared the police were closing in, and they decided to leave just the next day on the Friday. And they couldn't use the Land Rovers because they'd already been seen. So Brian Field, the lawyer, came to the farm to pick up his share of the money and take some gang members back to London to find extra vehicles. Then in different cars, they went back and picked up the others. So the robbers wiped down the farmhouse to get rid of any fingerprints, but they got spooked and then they asked Brian Field to just burn it down.
That's going to point later on, you Brian out. Was for-
yeah, that's a little bit suspicious. Yeah. But then they... So Brian was forced to admit to the gang later that he never ended up burning the house down because he just like was too busy / forgot / couldn't be bothered. So they were fucking furious. Yeah, they were furious. Or maybe he thought it was a bad idea and was like
us. Nah.
Plus like, he was like, I wasn't really at the farm, so it's not in my best interest to burn it down. Brian was, so he didn't do it. And then they were furious and they wanted to return to the farm. But by that time, the police had found it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they were like, cheers, mate.
Yeah.
So anyway, while all this is happening, at 5 a.m. on the day of the robbery, the head of Buckinghamshire CID arrived at the crime scene where he supervised evidence gathering. He then took statements from the driver and the postal workers. And they said about 15 hooded men dressed in boiler suits had been involved. But that was it. The police found no forensic evidence at the scene, so they spread their search out further. They also put a watch on the ports to stop anyone leaving via ship. Who, though? Who's going to leave?
Yeah,
they don't know.
How are you going to know?
They don't have any descriptions of them.
Right.
That was just, like, to show willing, I think.
Maybe they were, like, patting them down, like, how much cash do you have on you?
Do you have £3 million in cash? So... A £10,000 reward was offered by the post office. 5 days after the robbery, the police followed a tip from a farmer who noticed the robbers using this farmhouse. Like, it was usually, like, abandoned. And then he saw people there and he was like, it's a bit weird. So they searched the house and it was deserted. But they did find the Land Rovers and they had hastily been painted yellow.
What?
So they were like... Right, we can't use them, but maybe if we paint them yellow, and this was like, that is a bullshit idea. Like, call Brian.
Let's set the place on fire and let's paint our cars yellow. What more is going to point you out? Let's all dye our hair red.
Yeah. I think that was made in a panic, that decision.
Yeah.
The police also found loads of food, loads of bedding and loads of sleeping bags. So they knew that like there had been a lot of people there. They also found post office sacks, registered mail packages that are never going to be delivered, banknote wrappers and a Monopoly board game.
Oh, nice.
They were bored.
Yeah.
it was determined that although it was 1963, like there is nothing else to do.
Yeah.
It was determined that although the farm had been cleaned for fingerprints, some finger and palm prints had been overlooked, including those on a ketchup bottle and on the Monopoly set. Apparently afterwards they found out that the Monopoly set had been used after the robbery for a game, but instead of using the Monopoly money, they used real money.
Of course they did.
I reckon they were just like gambling.
You totally would. Yeah.
Despite the discovery of the farm, the investigation was not going well. The breakthrough came when Detective Chief Superintendent Millen met a barrister in a... This is silly. He met him in a smoking room of an exclusive West End club, and that person told him that someone was willing to inform on the gang.
Mm.
So the informant had been jailed just before the train robbery and was hoping to get parole and other favours by talking. He passed 18 names on to the detectives, and they matched up with the list being prepared from the fingerprints that were collected at the farm.
Wow.
So they could prove that, like, the informant wasn't lying because the fingerprints matched up. Photos of the men that were wanted were published, and some of the police weren't keen on publishing the photos because they feared that this would happen, and it did happen. The gang just like went to ground. They were like, fuck it, they know who we are, see you later. Yeah. Like, if they hadn't have done that, they would have just been walking around like normal.
They could have spotted them.
That was a bit of a foolish...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit of a foolish move. So the first gang member to be caught was Roger Caudry. He was with his friend William Boll, who was helping him lie low in return for a payment of old debts. They were living in a rented flat in Bournemouth, which is on the south coast. It's like the closest beach town to Andover, my hometown. Mm. It takes about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a really like nice beach. They paid 3 months' rent in advance and all in small bills.
Oh, guys.
So that was a bit fucking stupid.
Yeah. What else did they have? Which meant that their on their hands?
Yeah. That meant that the landlady... And the landlady was the widow of, like, a police inspector.
Oh, no.
So she was like, now's my time to shine. She suspected something was wrong and informed the police.
Great.
William Boll, he wasn't even involved in the robbery, but he was also sentenced to 24 years because they thought he was, because he was hanging out with Roger Caudry.
No.
And he died in prison. Yeah, he died in prison in 1970. Police later acknowledged that he was the victim of a miscarriage of justice.
Okay, thanks. I hate when that happens.
I know. So the other arrests followed. 8 of the gang members and several associates were caught. On Friday the 16th of August 1963, 2 people had decided to take a morning stroll in the Dorking Woods, which again I think is on the coast, and they were discovered. They discovered a briefcase, a holdall, and a camel skin bag, all containing money.
Wow.
They called the police, who also discovered another briefcase full of money in the woods. In total, £100,900 was found. They also found a bag with a receipt inside from a restaurant in Germany. It was made out to Herr and Frau Field. Police knew by then that Brian Field was a solicitor who helped purchase Leatherslade Farm. They confirmed that Brian and Karen Field had stayed in Germany near that restaurant that year and connected him to the money.
Wow.
The police went to Field's house to interview him. He had a story that implicated the robber Lenny Field as the purchaser of the farm and his boss as the conveyancer. He admitted to having visited the farm on one occasion with Lenny just to go and see if he wants to buy it. He didn't know that the police had the receipt, so he admitted freely that him and his wife had been in Germany, so like dobbed himself in there. He was then arrested on the 15th of September 1963, and Lenny had already been arrested. So the trial of the robbers began on the 20th of January 1964. So it really didn't take him that long to find
Two
them.
Months.
Yeah. The trial, which lasted 51 days and included 613 exhibits and 240 witnesses.
Wow.
On the 15th of April 1964, the trial ended with the judge describing the robbery as a crime of sordid violence inspired by vast greed. It wasn't that violent. They just knocked 2 people out. They didn't beat the shit out of any of them.
If you were one of those people, Talissa, I think you'd think otherwise.
I'm sure I'd feel a bit differently, but come on. Sordid violence, I don't think is really like the right term.
Yeah.
Vast greed, fair enough. And he passed a sentence of 30 years imprisonment on 7 of the robbers. The 11 men that were sentenced in total all felt aggrieved at what they considered to be an excessive length of sentence, which were longer than those given to many murderers or armed robbers. And to be honest, like, even people who murder people don't get 30 years.
I think that they probably wanted to make a show of it. Like, it was probably such big news mm-hmm. that they're like, we're going to make examples of you guys.
I think they made the train comically easy to rob. Yeah. And so, so they were train robbers who were sentenced later by different judges, and they received much shorter terms in England, noticeably shorter. So on the 12th of August, 1964, one of the robbers, Wilson, escaped from Winston Green Prison in Birmingham in under 3 minutes.
What?
A three-man team broke into the prison and freed him. 2 weeks after his escape, Wilson went to Paris for plastic surgery. And then by November 1965, he was in Mexico City visiting old friends and fellow train robbers, Bruce Reynolds and Buster Edwards, who also got away. So, like, they only caught, like, 11 of them.
Wow. Probably the ones that, barely did anything to. One of them was the guy who brought the Monopoly in the yellow paint.
Yeah. One of them, like, fucked the signal. They're like, 30 years.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So in July 1965, Ronnie Biggs escaped from Wandsworth Prison in London. A furniture van. This is ridiculous. A furniture van was parked alongside the prison walls, and a ladder was dropped over a 30-foot high wall into the prison during exercise time, allowing four prisoners to escape.
No.
Two other prisoners distracted the wardens, allowing the escape to go unseen.
What?
Oh dear. And then Ronnie Biggs paid a significant sum of money to be smuggled to Paris for plastic surgery. He acquired new identity papers, and then in 1970 he moved to Adelaide, Australia, where he worked as a builder, and he and his wife had a third son.
Aww.
Yeah, he was living it up. Tipped off that Interpol was showing interest, he moved to Melbourne, which really isn't that far away.
No.
It's about a 7-hour drive, I reckon, down the coast.
Yeah.
It's like not that far. Then he moved to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil because police discovered his Melbourne address, but there was no extradition treaty between Britain and Brazil.
Mm.
And additionally, he had a Brazilian son with a Brazilian woman, so that afforded him legal immunity.
That's similar to my story. Like, they went to Amsterdam mm-hmm. because you can't get extradited there. And then they had their son.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
Like, you should research where you can go where Britain can't get you.
Yeah.
Or, like, yeah. And as a result of that, he just lived openly in Rio for many years, safe from the British authorities.
Oh, my gosh.
So he's, like, you know, talking to the papers, like, having the time of his life. And he's like, come and get me. So in May 2001, he was age 71 and he had three strokes.
Whoa.
He voluntarily returned to England, accepting that he could be arrested because he stated that he wanted to walk into a Margate pub as an Englishman and buy a pint of beer. Oh.
That's all I want in life. I'd love to do that, actually. Yeah. I can relate.
So that's all he wants to do, is just walk into a pub as an Englishman and buy a pint of beer.
Yeah.
So that's just fucking great. I had to leave that quote in. And also, my friend Ruth lives in Margate.
Yeah.
It's like a beach town in Kent. And I read that to her, and she was in a pub and she read it out and everyone cheered.
Yes, that's why I love it.
I know.
I love it. I want to go into a Margate pub. Let's do that. Next time I visit, we're going to do that.
Yeah. We'll go visit Ruth. Like, she's got a lovely house in Margate.
Yes.
Like, oh, it's just like, it's good old British fun.
Yes.
So he was arrested on landing in Britain. And he was sent back to prison to serve the remainder of his sentence. He's 71. On the 2nd of July 2009, Biggs was denied parole by Justice Secretary Jack Straw, who considered Biggs to be still wholly unrepentant. Yeah, he's not sorry.
Yeah.
But he was released on the 6th of August, 2 days before his 80th birthday, on compassionate grounds. And he died on the 18th of December 2013, aged 84.
Wow.
So he still lived for four more years after he was released from prison.
He
spent 8
life.
Years in prison in total. He did good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the carriage that was robbed was kept for evidence for 7 years following the event, and then burned at a scrapyard in Norfolk, which is in the east, in the presence of police and post office officials to deter any souvenir hunters. And that is the story of the Great Train Robbery.
Wow, that is a hilarious story. I can't believe
it. I know. Ronnie Biggs was like, in Brazil. Buenos Dias.
That is amazing.
Wait, that's not Brazilian. That's Spanish, right?
They speak Portuguese in Brazil.
Oh. I know some Portuguese people. I know a few.
Well, tune in next week.
They're great fun.
Translation into Portuguese.
Yeah, and like Ronnie Biggs is a bit of a like cultural hero because he just totally got won over on the police and like he won. Do you know what I mean? He was an underdog and he won. And the British fucking love an underdog.
Oh, yeah. I also love that last little bit of like the postman and the policeman standing around this train cart just burning it to the ground.
Just so sad.
It's so sad. like it wasn't the train's fault.
I know. Also, like a bit I didn't include because I was trying to be quick was they realized that the security was really shoddy, and so they had carriages made that had like alarms on them and like all this kind of stuff. But like they only had 7 of those in the whole country because they were new and like they weren't like ready or something. So they had to use an old one, and they were like, "Oh fuck it, wait, Matt, we'll just do it this one time." Lost like
it's not gonna happen again.
£40 million, but it was inside info.
Yeah.
Somebody knew. Wow. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that story. That was an amazing story.
Good. And nobody died in either of our stories, which is always nice.
What a lighthearted family tale. This episode was family friendly.
It really was. And I don't think I called anyone a cunt. So that's a change.
Until now. On that note.
Until next time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll say goodbye. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next week. Again, have a great Thanksgiving, and...
Yeah, I do.
Talissa, have a great time in Dublin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm going to Dublin. I'll report back next week.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
Bye.
All right, love you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Transatlantic Crime this week. If you liked what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe.
And if you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Twitter at Transat Crime Pod, Instagram at Transatlantic Crime, and on Facebook with Transatlantic Crime Podcast.
Thanks, bye.